Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
I don't believe that still photography is ever going to rise to where it once was. I think it will stay where it is and it will be pursued by enthusiasts because it is and remains and always will remain a very good conduit for self-expression.
Welcome to the Adventure Podcast and episode 90 with Colin Pryor. Colin is known as one of the world's most respected landscape photographers. He was born in Glasgow and his ability to get out and into the Highlands is definitely what shaped his passion for the outdoors and fostered his interest in photography. His photographs are sensational and capture real sublime moments of light and the landscape, which, as you'll find out in this episode, are the result of meticulous planning and preparation and often take years to achieve. Colin is a photographer who seeks out patterns in the landscape and the hidden links between reality and the imagination. In this episode, we talk about his origins as a photographer, how his craft has taken him around the world, and we discuss his latest project in the Pakistani Karakoram. Colin's a bit of a hero of mine, and when I first visited Outward Bound age 16, a dozen or so of his images lined the walls of the canteen. It was humbling to sit down with someone who I've admired for so long, and to discover, as is often the case, that he's just a modest man who's managed to turn his passion into his career and his lifestyle. So I hope you enjoy this one as much as I enjoyed Colin's company. Finally, if you're enjoying the podcast, then please do leave us a review on iTunes. They make a huge difference to our ability to reach a wider audience. Okay, over to Colin Pryor. So, let's start at the start. Please, could you just introduce yourself? Tell me a bit about who you are and what you do and what you've done.
My name's Colin Pryor. I've been a photographer for 38 years, almost 40. I've managed to survive as an outdoor photographer for that length of period. The business has changed beyond recognition, and I've managed to see it to this point, not having shot any video so far.
That's rare, I would argue, in the modern world.
Very. And I got into photography because of its connection and affinity with more conventional art forms like drawing and painting. And at school, I was quite good at art. And the reason I know I was quite good at art was because there was someone in my class that was brilliant at art. And I realised that no matter how much I practised, going forward in my life, I could never be as good an artist as that guy was. He had an innate skill, an innate talent. He could draw a face and, I mean, it seems straightforward until you try and put the eyes and the ears and the nose instinctively in the right place. And, you know, I struggled with it, with that. And so I kind of recognised that there were people out there that had a talent and could be always much better than I could be, even with practice. Now, that's the way I think. Perhaps retrospectively, it wasn't the right thing. And it wasn't really until I was 23 that I discovered photography, and I found the means by which I could create the type of perfection that I aspired to with a camera, and you know, set off on my little journey.
So what was it that motivated the photography? Was it your want to find a way to be outdoors, or was it the art that came first, I suppose?
Well, ironically, I started scuba diving just recreationally, and I decided I would take a camera underwater. This kind of fascinated me, the idea of putting a camera in a Lexan housing and trying to capture some of the things I was seeing underwater. And I really knew nothing about photography at all. So I bought myself a Nikon FM and an Icolite underwater housing, and took it underwater. And I have to say that my early results were diabolical. I mean, they showed very, very little. And I realised what a mountain I had to climb in terms of learning not only about photography, but the whole physics of underwater photography. But I persevered with it, and it was very much a big learning process. And you know, I was struggling for information, and I was pointed at various experts, and these various experts weren't able to answer my questions. And I realised once I'd learned myself, you know, the right way to do things, that they weren't really experts because they didn't know what they were talking about. And what I tried to create underwater was this. It was a concept that I sort of invented myself, but I tried to reach a state of invisibility. And what that means is that, you know, you're underwater in the Scottish lochs for generally about half an hour, and that's not a great deal of time to take photographs. So when you're under the water, you want to make sure that you've got every possible opportunity to shoot anything you see. So it meant really organising your kit, you know, having really good diving equipment, making sure it was all maintained, it didn't squeak and didn't leak, and it was perfect. And it was a similar situation with the camera equipment. You know, you didn't want to set up this image and find that the flash wouldn't fire just at the moment you wanted that shot. So that kind of taught me, you know, about the necessity of having everything maintained and correct so that you could achieve the images that you had in your mind's eye. And I took that thereafter into the outdoors with me as well. And a lot of these big landscape photographs that I eventually began to work on, the result of what I have referred to as a military strike. And, you know, the most important part of any special forces mission is the reconnaissance. So you've got to go out there, you've got to be prepared to spend the time in the landscape and get to know it. And obviously I'll go out there when the weather is good, and sometimes you'll succeed and other times you'll fail. But if you fail, you'll realise when the best time to return is. You know, it might be, you know, the following year. You might go a month earlier, a month later, because the sun's going to be in a better position. And then, you know, the next part of that military strike is the preparation. And you know, we'll go back to what I was saying there about the underwater photography. You know, you check your bags when you get home, you clean out everything, you know, make sure your batteries are all ready to go. Everything you need there is packed so that, you know, when the weather breaks in your favour, that you don't need to check bags. You just lift them and put them in the car and go. And I've got also in the back of my car, I've got a sort of plastic box, and I refer to that as my survival box. And people laugh, you know, about the idea of having a survival box in the back of a Discovery when you're going into Scotland. It's hardly, you know, a wilderness. But if you've been up and camped overnight on one of the peaks in Torridon in January, you're going to get nowhere that's going to serve you food. And when you come off, you know, your sugar's low and you need food. So you've got to have the ability to cook something up because, you know, you might be driving home, even to you know, where I live in Glasgow, it's four and a half hours home. So it's a long drive, particularly when you're tired and you haven't really had a great deal of sleep in the tent at 3,000 feet or 1,000 metres. So so these are just some of the thoughts I have about the approach that I took with the panoramas. Because I guess the other thing about the panoramas is that they have got this sense of place about them, but they were never actually intended to be about the sense of place. It was always a moment I was trying to capture, and what I tried to do was work out in an area where the best viewpoint was to capture other mountains. And typically I was always looking for a peak that was surrounded by other peaks so that you've got that angularity in front of you. I mean, there's peaks, I mean, I've been asked, you know, most of my, you know, working life for photographs of Shialy and you know, Loch Rannoch. And I've never been on that mountain, but it's, you know, it's a monolith that stands with nothing round about it. There's no other hills that you can shoot the mountain from. And when you're up there, I assume, or from the photographs I've seen online, it, you know, it's just expanses of view and it's actually quite dull, you know. So I was looking for a particular mountain and a particular type of image, and then I was trying to go back there when I was going to capture something really special, you know, that light that transforms something that's pretty ordinary for most of its life into something exceptional, something extraordinary.
Fascinating. Okay, God, that gives me a lot to go on. So I guess you're an outdoorsman as much as you're a photographer, right? Where did that passion come from?
Well, I think what's driven me is a deep-rooted passion of the natural world. And mountains I found were the way that I could manifest that best through the medium of photography. I've kind of broadened that a bit, and I mean, the calendars that I continue to produce, they tend to not only have mountain photographs, you know, from high points, but they've also got seascapes and they've got forests in it, because you obviously want to speak to as broad a church as possible. And as much as I'm passionate about some of the views from the elevated points and mountains, they've got a limited appeal to the general public. You know, Munroists and fell walkers really love these photographs. The general public find them a bit perhaps daunting or intimidating. So it's a passion of the natural world. And strangely enough, when I was younger, I mean, I've always had a deep-rooted passion of birds, of wild birds. And I realised when I was younger that, and you know, because when I got into photography, there were so many routes that you could go into. You know, you could go into journalism and specialise in sports, and okay, you'd end up working at the time. You could get a staff job with a newspaper if you went in there as a freelance, and you know, you'd be pretty well looked after with expenses and a pension. And you'd never earn a great deal of money, but it was a pretty safe job. And, you know, if you liked sport, you were going to go out with teams to different parts of the world. And that was a great opportunity. And then, you know, you could go commercial, which is actually what I did, even although I'm known as a landscape photographer. I've never really made my living as one. You could go socially as well. You know, you could do, you know, weddings or high street, you know, children, families. There's always a big demand for that. And then, you know, there are quite a number of photographers that are, you know, my age that made a very good living from shooting stock. You know, they travelled around the world, and you know, their Getty or their other agencies, NPL, someone like that, would sell their images. And although they were doing that in a budget, they were able to pay their bills and go and do what they wanted. And they actually made money from the photographs. But as we all know, the currency of photography has been completely devalued. It's worthless. It's in exactly the same place as music is. And it just took 20 years longer to get there.
Well, can you go into detail on that, please, and explain why that is?
Well, it's Instagram. It's the, you know, it's the myriad images that we see on a daily basis on Instagram. And everyone's a photographer. I mean, I'm only doing what everyone else is doing. And as time goes on, the craft, which, you know, I'm trying to advocate through my workshops, will go. It will become irrelevant in the very near future.
Do you really believe that?
Yeah.
You think it'll go?
Yeah, it will. It will. You know, the marketplace always finds the cheapest way to do things. And I've said for a while that still photography will go, and it has already been eclipsed by videography. And, you know, when we get into higher resolutions on video, I mean, it's happening at the moment. You know, they'll pull the still off that they want for, and what's the still for anyway? It's going to go on a website. It's not as if it's going to go into print anymore. So, the images are just going to get pulled off. Nobody's going to hire a still photographer and a videographer. So video is the medium. But there's something a wee bit counterintuitive about this, and either people don't realise or they've forgotten. And that is, I mean, sometimes we, you know, we're on websites and, you know, we're sort of frustratingly trying to get a still image to play. And of course, it's a still image. And moving images are obviously a very good way to communicate with us online. The human brain can't store moving images. The human brain, the memory, stores images in single moments. So you can pick a book up, for instance, that you read when you were a student, and it might have been 20 years ago. You can go to a library, or you'll pick that book up perhaps somewhere randomly, and then you'll find that as soon as you open that book, you almost instantly know that you've read that book before, because the images are recalled from your brain very quickly. And, you know, conversely, you can sit and watch a movie, you know, on TV, until a sequence of events triggers a stored still image in your brain, and you realise that you've seen the film before and that you've wasted another hour of your life watching a movie you've already seen. And, you know, as an advertiser, surely the ability of recall of a powerful single image is much stronger than a video. I mean, you go into department stores, not that I do very often, but, you know, you happen to notice that they've got new video screens. And a lot of that stuff, I would submit, is whistling in one ear and right out the other, and nothing is sticking. And it's a bit, I think, you know, for the first time in history, we can make moving images for not very much money. I mean, it used to go, you know, you used to have to pay 20 grand to get a production company to come and even have a chat with you about a film. And now, you know, the whole thing has changed. So we can make moving content very, very cheaply. And is it a question of it's the emperor's new clothes? Now, a caveat that we're saying, I don't believe that still photography is ever going to rise to where it once was. I think it will stay where it is, and it will be pursued by enthusiasts, because it is and remains and always will remain a very good conduit for self-expression.
Well, that, I think that's the interesting point. Is you, just to use the music analogy that you brought up earlier, it's like listening to vinyl. You know, vinyl has seen a resurgence. It is continuing to see a resurgence. And that's because people want to listen to an album and they want to hear the sound of vinyl, don't they?
They do.
How is it any different?
But it's not, and there is a great parallel with that. But the big challenge, of course, for up-and-coming photographers or filmmakers or content providers or whatever they're calling themselves now, is how they make a living. And the problem is, and I know this from, you know, I know one or two commissioning editors that are in senior positions, and, you know, they've said to me that they've got a drawer full of content, video, films of people who are friends and people they know and people that have asked if they'll have a look at stuff, and they physically don't have enough hours in the day to actually sit and watch that. And, you know, it's an awful lot easier to look at a portfolio of still images. You can do that quite quickly and consume that and see what the photographer, the artist's about very quickly. But with a film, you've got to sit, you know, and give up, you know, 3, 4, 5 minutes of your time to see what that filmmaker's about.
Well, and to get a little bit philosophical about it, I think that's the, you know, I work in film and photo, and I have never produced a showreel, and I hope I never do, because creating, it's slightly controversial, but creating beautiful moving pictures is not that difficult to do. Creating outstanding, that's a whole different conversation, but it's storytelling. I think that's what separates people nowadays, and that feeling and that emotion. And to come back to what you said right at the start, you know, you're an artist, and that an artist and a photographer, you're trying to say something with the photographs that you create. That's much deeper and richer and more intelligent than just taking a photograph of something that you see, isn't it?
It is. I mean, there's quite a lot in what you said there, and I think it's important for photographers or filmmakers. I mean, I don't have a great deal of experience in film, but the content, there's so much content on the internet where it's just beautiful drone shots, for instance, and there's no story, or it's photographers out in the hill, and, you know, they're videoing their journey into a wild place, and, you know, the highlights them sitting, you know, brewing up, you know, and there needs to be something more than that. There needs to be a dialogue. And I mean, I've just spent a week in Harris making a video with Sigma. And, you know, I've obviously done this before, but I mean, the guy that was shooting the video, I mean, he shoots more images in a day than I shoot in a year. And, you know, there's so much footage required, you know, from two cameras, from two different angles, that, you know, I realise that my job by comparison is so much simpler. And I shoot very, very few images, I mean, because I know what I want to see. And I think that is so important. I think there's a lot of photographers out there, you know, very talented photographers. There's a lot of professionals out there, and they don't necessarily have something to say about the world. You know, they're good at the technical aspects, they go through the motions, but it's a bit like a marriage without love. It's like a marriage of convenience, but there needs to be, you need, what I think creates inspiring photography is the, you know, the artist has got to have a burning passion for what he or she is trying to capture, and know in their own mind very clearly that the type of image they're after, and more importantly, what they don't want to capture.
Yeah, that's interesting. So how much do you think the character of the photographer plays into the success of the final product?
A great deal. I think it's got to do what that photographer or artist wants to communicate, and you know what you see from competent work is a synergy between the images. You know, they can be in different environments, but there's a definite thumbprint in there, and it's a vision that's honed. And you know, it's how you can remain true to that cause and expand your work to incorporate new projects, so that you're raising your own creative horizons. We need to move forward. I mean, I shot for almost exclusively personally. For 25 years, I shot those panoramas with a 6-17 film camera, and it was a combination of the hassle of shooting my film and having it processed and then scanned. But I found latterly that that format was becoming a bit of a creative straitjacket, and I really needed to go out and hunt new game, which is what I did. But I've kind of moved back. I mean, I'm beginning work on a new project, and I'm using another type of panoramic format. It's not 3x1, it's 2x1, but I'm working within that 2x1 format. And these formats, I mean, they were actually conceived by Linhof, the German camera company, and they made the Linhof Technorama 617. And they used to make that camera in, I think they originally made it in the 60s, and it didn't sell that well. And they stopped manufacturing the camera, and the second-hand price, this would probably have been about 1986, 87, 88, the second-hand price of the camera started to go up and up, and they eventually re-engineered it and brought in the Technorama 617S. And I had the first camera in the UK because I realised there was something. I kind of saw a magazine, a US and American magazine, and there were 617 images in it. There were actually crops from 5x7 sheet film into 3x1s. And there was something about that format that really captured my imagination. And I kind of thought, I could use this to shoot Scotland in a new way, which is what I did. But to go back to what I was saying, Linhof, so they designed that camera, and they also made, it was a lesser known camera, they also made a 2x1 camera as well. And the lens had an 8mm lens rise built into it, was mounted on the camera with an 8mm lens rise, and it was really designed for 2x1 panoramas of buildings. It was an architectural photographer, and it wasn't ideal for landscape because it kind of had that 8mm lens rise on it, and it also had a tripod hole on the top of the camera, and you could mount it with an adapter upside down so you could get an 8mm lens drop on it. But as I say, you know, it kind of defeats the purpose when you've got an 8mm lens rise and you want to point the camera down because you're getting convergence. But the format wasn't for landscape at the time, I didn't think, as powerful as the 3x1. But it's a format that appeals more to me now. And I'm using that. I'm shooting with a Fuji GFX. And I mean, you've not got 2-1 on that, unfortunately. You've got 16-9, which is just a little bit deeper, but it's pretty close to it. Very, very satisfying to see.
But you speak a lot about the technical side of it there. And obviously it's a very technical game, which I think that's maybe a lot of what we've lost now is, you know, over there on the floor, there's a Sony A7, which is what I shoot on. And I point it at things, and it takes beautiful photographs. When you're going to take a photograph of something, you approach it in a wholly different way, don't you? You know, you talk about that recon approach, that special forces approach. How does that process for you play out? Where does it start and end?
Well, I'm constantly looking for new locations. I've discovered quite a few new locations this year. Just where they're not discovered locations, you know. I mean, when I publish the photographs, people are going to think, where is that? But there's still areas out there that are very rich photographically, I'm trying to capture the essence of that natural world in a way that that transposes the viewer somewhere else. And I've always said, it's not really what's in the photograph, it's where it takes you. You know, it should take you and move you somewhere beyond that photograph, wherever that is. Even, you know, it's a momentary feeling. But that's the challenge, I feel. And the other thing that really excites me and is becoming increasingly difficult to find, not just in Scotland, but anywhere in the world, is this idea of undisturbed places. Places where, and they're not truly undisturbed because, you know, people talk about Scotland and the wilderness, but it's a man-made wilderness. And so, but these are places that are undisturbed. You know, they're places where there's not dog walkers going through on a daily basis. There's actually very, very little human intervention in them. As I say, you know, with social media, it's almost impossible to save these places. They'll be found. I mean, I'm not a particularly active Instagrammer, but occasionally I've posted images and deliberately not mentioned where they are, and someone asks, and I don't answer, but someone else does on your behalf. And, you know, once it's out there, it's out there.
Is there an ethical issue for you around that?
Yes and no. Yes, because I don't really want the footfall there. Not through selfishness, so that I'm the only person with those photographs there, but because I've seen so much evidence in Scotland during my lifetime of places becoming trashed. And once the public in general find them, they diminish significantly. I see it constantly, year on year. I've seen the most dreadful environmental vandalism happening in some places. And it makes me very, very sad. But I also know that if I don't go out and find these places, someone else will. And it's what drives me anyway, just to find these undisturbed places. And I've also, although I'm obviously known for these big pictures, you know, I'm also fascinated with what I call intimate landscapes. They're not macro pictures, but they're generally taken from, a metre away. And they're landscapes in miniature. You still need the beginning and an end. But you can say a great deal about the environment, and if you've got a book, they're ideal for breaking the mapping in a book up. You know, you pick and you think, you come to a picture like that and you navigate the picture differently.
But that, you've just nailed something that I really wanted to talk to you about, which is, you know, you saying that the photography and the craft is dying, and I'm desperate to disagree with you because, you know, the way that you create these books, they are designed to be sat down with and you go from start to finish, don't you? And that is art in and of itself. And it's not an accident that that picture appears on page 7 and that one's on page 8, is it?
No, that's true. And, I've been fortunate that I've had control. I need control of the design because the design... You know, how many photographic books have you seen ruined by bad design? And, you know, even although you've got a mainstream publisher on it, I'm very fortunate insofar as I've worked with a designer for about 25 years. And, you know, and I can say to her, I don't like that. I really don't like that, Mandy. Do, you know, and she's not pissed about that. And if she feels strongly about it, she'll say, no, leave that just now. And then, you know, but if I go back the next time we meet and I say, look, Mandy, I'm not really sure about that, so she'll knock it out. But she'll challenge me and she'll do things. I'll say, God, that looks great. You know, but there's a kind of marriage with a designer. And if somebody says, you know, we're going to publish a book and this is a designer, you know, they've got their own ideas about the way they work. And, my own designer has realised that, you know, because I've worked with her for so long, you know, her talent is letting the photography breathe. And that is a validation of her good design. I don't mean that my photography is more important than her design. It's a marriage of both. But, you know, we both embrace that less is more philosophy. You know, it's about subtracting in photography, but also in design. And just having, you know, it's that contemporary classic look you're looking for so that it doesn't date. You know, if you've got the most up-to-date fonts, so you're better with sort of classic. It's a bit like, you know, if you went to bathroom showrooms just now and you were going to do your bathroom up at the... You know, with leading, up to the moment, furniture within that bathroom. You know, in 10 years' time, it looks so dated. You know, because they're so cutting edge. Whereas if you've got a more sort of classic design there, you know, you'll get a bit more time out of it before it starts looking like an old person's place.
Yeah. No, and it's clear that you've thought about all of this obviously a lot. It plays a huge part in your career and success. And I think if you're to use the kind of author or the writing analogy, some people write because it's cathartic or for the joy of it, and some people write to be read. Do you take photographs for other people, or are they for you first?
They're always for me, you know. And it's quite funny because sometimes in workshops and we're chatting away to the, you know, the client, and somebody will say to me, but Colin, you know where the commercial, you know where the commercial opportunities are for landscape. And I have never, ever, ever gone out once to take a landscape photograph because I thought it would make me money. And I was just saying this to someone a couple of days ago. You know, in the early days when I was an up-and-coming photographer, the calendar publishers didn't like 35 mil because, you know, it was a small bit of film and it didn't reproduce very well in print, and they wanted better quality print. The same way as the agencies specified, you know, that they wanted, you know, fashion objects shot in a 10x8 format or 5x4. So I bought Hasselblad, and I loved it, the Zeiss lenses, and I hated the square format. But I used to go out and shoot the sort of work that I've always shot, and I would submit the transparencies to the to the calendar publishers. And, you know, they would call me up and they would say to me, Colin, we really like your photography, but do you not think you could go out and shoot a harbour or a castle or some place that, you know, people recognise? And I politely said to them, well, I'll give it some thought, but there was no chance of me ever doing that. Now, if I had done, you know, I could have made money, and they would have published calendars at the time when, you know, as an up-and-coming photographer, everyone needs money. But I kept true to my passion. And it's ironic, I mean, not so much now, but 10, 15 years ago, these publishers were all wanting to publish, you know, corporate versions of my calendars to sell to businesses with the panoramas of Wild Places in them. So that's kind of changed quite a bit. But, you know, what I'm doing now isn't as unique as it was. There's a lot of people out there now out wild camping and producing some fantastic work. But again, it needs to I feel it needs to be part of a bigger project. It needs to be honed at something rather than you know, photographs, disparate landscape photographs, you know, shot the same way so often. You know, you see this again and again, the same type of subject matter, the same sort of approach. And but at the end of the day, it's a conduit for personal expression. And if that's what floats people's boats, that's what floats people's boats.
Well, that's a big, you know, big interesting tangent. Well, not that interesting tangent, maybe around social media and how the algorithms work. And, you know, if you stick a little person on the top left silhouetted of the Kulin, it'll get more hits than if you don't.
Very much.
And that's the problem. But I think what's quite inspiring is that you say, I go out and I do what I love, and, you know, thank God that works, right? And it will continue to. But I think part of that is that campaign process. You know, where we are now, you've got this new exhibition, and I haven't been to see it yet because I've only just arrived, but it's not just one image, is it?
No, I think we've got 17 there, and I was fortunate because upstairs, you know, it's quite a big space, and I've got three big acrylics in there, which are supported by slightly smaller pieces. But it's one thing that we don't see. We don't see big photography, and the reason we don't see big photography is because, you know, they need to be shown indoors in big spaces which need to be heated. They need to be staffed, and these spaces, they can't make sufficient margin on selling photography to make it a viable proposition for them. So we seldom see big photography, and if you've got big files that are well executed, printed beautifully, it's such an experience to you experience the landscape in a very, very different way when the pieces are big. So if you're in the area, I understand that the exhibition's going to remain up after the festival's over. I'm not sure for how long, but if you're in the Kendal area or in the lakes, and you're interested in mountain photography, then it's not a bad place to hopefully get some inspiration.
Do you get much joy out of exhibitions?
Yeah, I mean, it's a privilege to be given the space to have your work shown. And yes, but, it's a strange thing. You know, the creation of the work is really what drives me. And then, you know, the design and the collation of it and moving things around, I mean, that takes a lot of time and effort. and you're totally absorbed, and then you get proofs in and you check them and there's some adjustments to be made here and there. And then the book gets published and, you know, you sort of go through it from front to back two or three times, and then you don't really pay much attention to it. It's kind of done. You know, it's like, if you've got a big sort of exposure piece in a newspaper, you've got that, and you know, it comes and it goes, but, there's not... I mean, you're delighted to get the exposure, but it doesn't, you know, really fill you with pleasure in the way that shooting a fantastic picture does. It's quite strange that in a way. And occasionally, you know, you might publish a book and 3 months pass and you kind of dip back into it, because it's often like when you're out shooting and you get some pictures, it's probably not a good idea to... I mean, you know the ones that need to be deleted, but... if you keep the images 2 or 3 weeks and go back and look at them again, you'll see slightly different things in some of the images. I'm not saying that a bad picture will become a good one, it won't, but I think it's sometimes premature to cull too many images initially. I mean, you know, any rejects that are technically bad, you know, yes, but it's sometimes worthwhile, you know, other images, and if you've got big files, you might see an area within one that that's got something that captures your imagination. So, it's a bit like RAM and ROM. You know, it's kind of got to drop out the RAM into the ROM memory, and it's sometimes too raw initially, and you've just kind of got to let it drop a bit. So that it's, you're kind of looking at it with a wee bit more of a memory attached to it rather than just as content.
And that then changes the dynamic, doesn't it? Is it for you or is it for others? And it might be for you at the start. But then I suppose maybe some of your favourite images might not be commercially viable and you've still taken them.
Favourite images, I've obviously got some personal favourites. But I'm always fascinated, and you know, often if I do presentations, which I do in my workshops, I'll often ask people what their favourite image is, and it's not through narcissism that I'm asking that question. I don't want my ego stroke. Oh, that's a fabulous picture, Colin. That one there, I really like that. It's a wonderful picture. I don't care about that. What I'm interested in is what people are responding to, because what we as photographers need to be very careful of is, and I see this an awful lot, is that we don't indulge ourselves in what I refer to as photographers' pictures, because we need to be able to communicate. At the end of the day, I'm trying to communicate messages through my work subliminally. And if I don't understand the language that the public understand, then I'm not going to get the opportunity to communicate with them. And it's also got to do with context. And I could show you a picture of a golden eagle I've shot, which I haven't, but I could show you a picture of a golden eagle. And you might say to me, oh, that's a great shot of the eagle. Where did you get that? You know, be a reaction to say. And that would be fine. But if I had a collection of work with the Scottish Highlands and some pine forests and some mountains and lochs, and you're kind of building that up, and then you look at the golden eagle in the context of this other work, it suddenly becomes linked to that work that's come before and the work that will come after. And I use that eagle analogy, but also... I referred earlier to those intimate landscapes that help break a book up. And to show that image as a standalone, you won't probably elicit a great response from many people. But seen in context of what I've just described there, it suddenly fits in like a piece of a jigsaw into a bigger picture. The general public... in terms of photography, the general public see photography largely as calendar pictures. That, you know, if you show the classic calendar picture to the general public, they like to see a horizon, you know, they like the foreground there, they like, you know, different colours. People, the general public love sunsets and sunrises. Red colours are lovely, of course. But if you show the general public an image that doesn't have a horizon, like an intimate landscape, and if it's too clever, they won't get it. You know, and if you go abstract, you know, sometimes you look at abstract photography and you don't know whether it's an aerial photograph or if it's something that's a foot wide. And I always kind of think with abstracts is that there should be a visual clue in there that someone can, oh, I see what that is. Oh, that's quite clever. But if they can't work that out, they don't know what they're looking at. It's just frustrating. Now, I know there's some, on my workshops, I've met one or two photographers who are superb abstract photographers. I mean, they can really produce beautiful images. And, you know, I've encouraged them to continue doing that, but they don't necessarily communicate very well with the public. Now, I'm not for a minute saying that we should dumb down our aspirations as artists and as creative people to shoot and spoon-feed the public with the images they want to see. We need to challenge that. But, in you know, there's a middle ground in there somewhere. You know, we need to move that forward to try and communicate in new ways with them, but we need to be able to do it in a language that they understand.
Yeah.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's so interesting, I think, the balance between your commercial needs and your personal passions as an artist and a photographer. And I would like to ask you to kind of put the camera in a bag for a second and to talk a little bit about how much, or not, how much the travel and the experience of going to these places is important to you, and those journeys.
Well, it's everything. Going there is everything, but I think you it's the camera that's taken me out there. And it's in the bag, don't worry. It's in the bag. And but, you know, it's you know, with some people it's fishing. You know, they'll go to small Scottish hill locks, and you know, they might, in the course of time, that they might go and catch tiger fish in, you know, Lake Kariba in Zimbabwe, and or, you know, they might spread their wings and go and fish in Alaska or somewhere where there's big game. But without the fishing, they wouldn't be going there. And that analogy for me works with photography. But you know, when I go out to shoot, you know, I go out and the camera's in the bag, and the camera doesn't come out until I see something that connects with me, either intellectually or creatively. The camera's just a tool; it stays in there, and I'm out there. I'm continuously looking. And observing, I'm connecting. And that's why I always work alone. Because if you go out with someone, you're inevitably going to start talking rubbish about, you know, well, I like this sort of whiskey or that sort of whiskey. Or, I mean, I've no real interest in football, but, you know, you find subjects to talk with and you're not noticing, you know. And if there's conversation there, you don't get the same opportunities to you know, to flush wildlife. You're not connected. I can't do it. So I'm always out there alone. I want to be alone. And it's a kind of communion with the landscape. I become part of that, or I feel I do. I'm trying to find, what I'm trying to find and what drives my work is a fundamental fascination between the relationships between the elements of the natural world. Now, that might be trees and rocks or mountaintops and snow and clouds. It's all... And I see wildlife as part of that. That's just another element within that. That whole journey thing, and you know, I touched earlier briefly on wildlife, and you know, it's taken me a while, but I recognise it as part, you know, it's another element within the landscape, and the way the trees and the rocks are. And when I was younger, I realised that landscape photography, it was down to me to arrange and organise everything in that viewfinder. I mean, what you're doing is that you're disassembling the landscape in your brain, and you're reassembling it through the viewfinder in a way that corresponds to the way you feel about the world. Whereas with wildlife photography, okay, you need to be pointing the camera in the right place at the right time, but and you know, wildlife photographers have really had the benefit of technology and cameras, you know, high ISOs and autofocus tracking now and no blackout, and you know, like the Sony A1, you know, it's just a fantastic camera for wildlife photography. So they're really getting the benefit of that. But so often with wildlife photography, particularly if you're shooting at 30 frames a second, you know, 3 seconds, you've got 90 images to look at. You know, I've heard some photographers say to me they kind of feel it's a bit of a fraud, that in there somewhere there's a really good picture. Now, that's not to take away the knowledge and the skill that many wildlife photographers have accumulated over their lifetimes. I'm not trying to make that statement at all. You know, many of them have got deep knowledge about where to find birds and animals at different times of the year. You know, the point I was making is that for me, I saw wildlife photography as it was chance that necessarily would give you the best picture, whereas with landscape, it was all down to me and the ability to arrange these elements in the viewfinder in a way that you know, corresponded to the way that I saw the landscape in front of me.
Yeah, and I think that's right. And there's no professional wildlife photographer here, so they can't defend themselves. But it's a different thing, isn't it? You're pressing the shutter once to make that moment. I think make is a particular, you know, choice of word. Whereas trying to capture a kingfisher, the exact moment that, you know, they pierce the fish or whatever, that's reportage. That, and of course, wildlife photography is artistry in its own way. But
indeed,
we're comparing with, you know, squash and tennis.
Yeah, very much.
Yeah.
Very much.
So just a slight curveball, how much, you know, you've been traveling the world for a while now and you've seen a lot of it and you've seen it change, and you talked about Scotland and how it's a man-made landscape. Could you just explain what you mean by a man-made landscape?
Well, the Scotland that most people recognise with a heather on it, I mean, the heather's not natural. It's the result of overgrazing, mainly by sheep and by the huge deer populations that are on the estates. And the glens were at one time heavily forested, but most of that forest would have gone by the 17th century. For charcoal, there was a lot of charcoal, you know, for iron smelting and for shipbuilding and construction in general, and of course for heating. The hills are bare now, and you know, we're seeing now a lot of rewilding beginning to happen in Scotland. And you know, one or two people have you know, asked me, am I going to get involved in that story? And I would like to, but I think it's very difficult to do anything other than a reportage job on rewilding. You know, you've got people planting trees, putting deer fences up, and other people have already done that and done it, you know, very well. So I think it's a job for someone else.
It's journalism, isn't it?
It is journalism. And it's not really what it doesn't interest me doing that type of work.
No, that makes sense. And I think as well, you know, the state of the world, and without being too pessimistic, you know, things aren't brilliant at the moment. Things are changing. Does that affect and influence your work, or do you try to keep it separate?
I mean, I've you know, throughout my career, I keep my opinions to myself. I keep off social media. You know, I'll post photographs, or, you know, if there's anything, you know, worthwhile mentioning, I'll put in Facebook. But I don't get involved with causes. I don't get involved with, you know, the two hot potatoes, politics and religion. I mean, you know, because they're, you know, I mean, Scotland's a divided country at the moment. And, you know, if you start making opinions about your opinion about, you know, independence, for instance, you know, you've got a big part of the population that are going to start saying, well, I like his pictures, but I don't like his politics. You know, and, I've kind of learned that, you know, people aren't interested in my opinions. You know, they like my work as a photographer, you know, and that's all that's important to me. But, you know, that's all that should be important.
Well, there's two arguments, aren't there? There's one that says that we should use our platforms for being vocal, but the other, the counter argument, is actually there's, I would argue, maybe controversially, there's a level of arrogance around thinking we're qualified to have one. You know, yeah. You're a photographer.
Exactly. I'm a photographer. And, you know, you've seen it, you know, on television, you've got pop stars there, you know, mouthing off their opinion. You know, they may be fantastic artists, but, you know, why should we be interested in what they have to say about politics? I think it's a mistake.
So if you're not interested in politics or, well, if you're not going to talk about politics and religion, sorry, I should say, what are you trying to say with the work that you create?
Well, I mean, I know I'm not going to save the planet. I've known that for a long time. But I just want to try and communicate the sublimity of the natural world and just what is actually out there that, you know, it's sometimes difficult to touch. But, you know, what I have recognised is that the general public are so divorced from the natural world. I mean, you know, their ability to distinguish not just birds, but trees and plants, you know, because they've not spent any time there. And, you know, everyone bangs on about the environment, but if you haven't spent any time in it, how can you have an empathy with it?
Well, you say exactly, and you say you're not going to save the world, but you're doing your bit, because there's this really cheesy David Attenborough quote that I love, which is people will never protect what they don't love, and they'll never love what they haven't experienced.
Indeed.
And so you're essentially giving them that experience, aren't you?
Well, I'm trying to show them something they might not witness themselves, highly unlikely. But what's it, you know, is it going to change their behaviour? No. But, you know, I do it for me, not for them. But I know when it's working, you know, I know the pixels at work that communicate something special. But I'm not doing it for that reason. I'm doing it for myself. But hopefully it takes people to a place that in the course of time won't exist.
Yeah. I said to you at the start, I sat in Outward Bound at 16 and there were 20 of your photos surrounding me at Lochiel Canteen. So maybe that did something. But I think there is, you know, we hang pictures on our walls, don't we? We're nesters as a species, and looking at those images as we do when we hang them there, it has an effect on how we feel about the place.
It, very much. And wall art is really one area where photographers can sell. Excuse me. Photographers can sell their images if they're doing it in the right way. It's a difficult thing to do properly. And I'm currently at the moment working on a new website that we're not going to launch before Christmas because it's too close now. But I think we're looking at the beginning of February. And it's going to offer a much, much wider range of artwork and sizes and in different media. And that'll be done and fulfilled by a third party. And it's taken quite a bit of investment and time, a lot of time to do. But the internet is really where it is for photographers. I mean, retail, the high street is a very, very challenging environment. I still deal with retailers, but, you know, going back to your statement there about the all the frame prints up in Lochiel, you know, back in the, you know, between 95 and probably 2005, there were lots of independent retailers, and I used to have great distribution amongst most of the galleries throughout the UK, and I sold a lot of that work. But of course, it had to be published. I was running prints at a thousand at a time to get the unit cost down to where I needed to be. So that work had to be stored, and you know, it was distributed. And you know, I had distribution in Germany and in France, and a bit in Italy and a bit in the US. And you know, it was a big business, and I kind of thought, you know, I kind of recognised where photography was going, and I built that business, and I spent a lot of time and money going to art exhibitions. And, you know, I went to New York as well, and exhibited there, and I kind of wanted something that was my own, that wasn't dependent on other people commissioning me to do commercial photography. And of course, that whole business, you know, it sort of dwindled away because the retailers couldn't survive in the high street. I mean, there's very few local frame shops now. I mean, there might be one or two, but you know, the problem they have is that, you know, they're doing football jumpers and people's artwork, and they're making a living from that. But you know, they haven't got the space or the capacity or the scale to start producing big pieces and packaging, and I mean, it's a factory. You need a factory to be able to do that. That's a challenge. You know, it's where can photographers make a living going forward? I mean, if you can't sell pictures and make money from that, which is over, how then do you survive as a photographer? Because it's important, I suppose, to stress that you need to be able to afford to follow your own dreams. And you know, what some photographers haven't managed to work out is they're not going to get paid for what they want to do. They'll need to live other people's dreams. And I was fortuitous when I was younger because I worked in events, I worked in exhibitions and trade exhibitions. And, you know, I had three photographers that worked for me, and we used to do about between 40 and 45 trade shows a year. And, you know, I had the franchise to sell photography in these. It's pre-digital, obviously. But, you know, people, you know, were paying £125 to have one electric plug put in their stand. So, you know, a couple of hundred quid for photography was nothing. And that's really what set me up in business and helped establish me. And then, of course, I started to get creative work from British Airways, and that kind of gave me, you know, a bit of recognition as an artist. But it was the exhibitions, and, you know, there were intense periods that I worked, and then there was downtime. I mean, exhibitions tend to avoid summer holidays and Christmas. So actually, you know, because I had money, you know, coming in, and the good thing was that with exhibitions, most of them are annual. The big ones tended to be biannual, the biggest ones. You kind of knew roughly what sort of money you would bring in the following year. So I was actually, that enabled me to go out and follow my own passion in the Scottish landscape. And it was through that work that I got recognition for that Scottish panoramic work that I got recognition from British Airways, and they commissioned me to shoot 4 calendars. So I got round 50 countries over that 4 years. Wow. Up the front end of aircrafts, and I had a fantastic budget to do it on. And no one will ever commission travel photography like that again. It was just right place, right time.
Yeah, and like you say, the world's changed, and it's interesting what you say though about the commerciality of it, because, and how do photographers now, young photographers, get into it? I think it's easy for me to say because I do it for a living, but The question is whether or not we need to do it professionally. I think it's often when you say to someone, I'm a photographer, they say, oh, professional. It's like one of the first things they say. And you kind of go, yeah. And they sort of like, there's this reverence. And you're like, well, hang on, it's just my job. But, you know, amateur is kind of, I think amateur is looked at as a bit of a, we look down on amateurs. Amateur, I don't know if you know this, I only found out this year, comes from Latin, amor for the love. Amor. I mean, amateurs do it for the love of it. And so, you know, do we need to be paid for it? There are so many amazing photographers out there who we don't even know they're taking images. They're making pictures and we don't know about it.
I agree.
And I don't know, I find a lot of power in that because it makes me feel like, as an art, that's why I disagree with you in a good way. It's not dying. It's just the industry's changing.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that too. I don't think it's dying. It's changing. It's learning how to survive in that industry. No, I think that there will always be a demand for professional image makers. I mean, that's for certain. I think what's changed though is the number. I mean, I never really use the term amateur photographer. I tend to refer to non-professionals as recreational photographers. But there are so many recreational photographers out there. I mean, there's a lot of retired people that, or there's people that work in shifts and they might do 2 days photography a week. They might be shooting pets, they might be shooting weddings, they might be shooting people, they might be shooting landscapes, but they've eroded the day rates of working photographers to such a degree that it's hardly worthwhile, you know, for what you've been paid. Because when I came into photography, it was one of these backdoor professions where, you know, I mean, I started working, you know, when I went freelance, I started to get work from a group of advertising agencies. There were 7 agencies in Glasgow. They were called Rex Stewart and Associates. And there were some big agencies in there, and they had, one of the agencies had in-house photography. So the group used to buy a lot of the below-the-line work in-house, and for the big campaigns, they'd be in London, you know, with the big-name photographers shooting the campaigns. You know, it was all no video then. It was all stills. But, you know, I was earning the same day rate as a lawyer or a doctor would then, from those ad agencies for working at that. And I mean, you know, we're not doing that now.
Well, adapt or die, isn't it? That's, yeah.
But things change, and it's, so you could, you know, back then you could make a lot of money. There was quite a lot of people in London making lots of, you know, really big money as still photographers, and it was skilled, and of course it was driven by the fact that everything was going into print and they wanted the highest quality images for print. So that demanded, you know, if you were working in studios, you know, with 5-4 cameras, and because you were having to stop apertures down, you know, you needed lots of really powerful flash, and then, you know, on to location with all that gear and crews of people polishing cars, and you know, yeah, it was a different time. And of course, you know, a lot of the fashion guys that were in London, you know, they were, you know, rubbing shoulders with all the supermodels, and, you know, it was a way of life. You know, they had access to people who were really wealthy.
Maybe you should have gone into that.
I wasn't cut out for that.
Hey, so just to draw us to a close, I always ask 2 questions at the end of every interview. Interpret them as you see fit. What scares you?
What scares me? I think what scares me most throughout my working life is not having enough money. Not having enough money. And you know, since I started working for myself, which was in 1982, you know, I've been hard at it. I mean, and I'm still working at that pitch all the time. You've got to, you know, I mean, don't get me wrong, I've got a very nice life still, but it's like having an aircraft carrier at sea. It needs all the other ships to maintain it. So you've just got to keep at it all the time. It's relentless. And you know, I mean, I can't keep going forever, but, you know, I do something that I'm passionate about. So, you know, I'll probably give it another 5 years. And as long as people want to come and, you know, learn on the workshops, I'll keep running these. I mean, I might wind them down a wee bit in the course of time, but I enjoy doing them, and we're going to some of the best places in Scotland for photography. So that's what I would say. It's that ability to maintain your lifestyle, you know, and I've been able to do that. I've been very fortunate, and of course, you know, health plays into that as well. And you know, again, fortunately, I've managed to have good health all my life. And if you don't, then you know, you need to cut your cloth accordingly.
Mm. Yeah. What brings you hope?
What brings me hope? Just the fact that the sun rises every morning and sets every evening, and the seasons, the changing seasons. I like these cycles. It's that repetition. It's something comforting in that. And, you know, as someone said to me recently, you know, and he's a man that's is a bit older than me. He said, "Colin, when you're waking up in the morning and you're still breathing," he said, "that's a big bonus."
Ace. Yeah, I think you've seen more sunrises and sunsets than most, eh?
Yeah, I've had my fair share of them. It's fantastic. I mean, of the two, I think I prefer sunrise. Just, you know, because you get mists that form up, and it's just something fresh and new about it all. But having said that, I've witnessed some fantastic sunsets in the mountains as well, and it's been a great journey. I've had a great journey, and in many ways, you know, I think I'm the end of an era, certainly of you know, having lived through the best years of analog photography and lived through the digital revolution, and of course that created new business models which weren't previously possible. So it's really been the workshops that have maintained my standard of living. I started them in 2007, and that's really where the only money in photography is at the moment. It's in education, it's in people. So the business has become far more about people and less about images. Mm. But I've never lost that passion for pictures. And you know, I was saying to someone recently, I mean, when I was in you know, doing the exhibitions, we worked in Earlscoat and Olympia and in GMEX, and there were some international venues we went on as well, but obviously there were some in Glasgow, and that's where I started. And I knew, because of the press days, I knew a lot of the more mature press photographers. And of course, they'd turn up, you know, there was a press call, and they'd turn up and they'd come into the press office, and they all had cars, taxis, you know, there were the taxis there, you know, company taxis that were paid for by the newspaper. So, they, you know, champagne, right away, champagne. So, you know, they wouldn't do anything until they had three glasses of champagne. And, you know, they were so, so funny. I mean, I used to have tears running down my face just listening to them. And you know, talk to him about photography, you know, cameras, what? And I kind of recognised that they'd kind of rusted out. And, you know, they'd been doing those exhibitions and all these press calls year after year after year. And probably 9 times out of 10, their picture wouldn't even get into the newspaper because it'd been knocked out with something else that came in. And they were just, you know, disinterested in the whole thing. And, you know, I'm as passionate about taking images now as I was when I first picked up a camera. And, you know, that frightens me as well. If I didn't have that, what I would do.
Brilliant. We'll leave it there. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Thanks for listening. You can find out more about Colin's work at colinpryor.co.uk. The podcast is a Cold House production and is hosted by Matt Pycroft and produced and distributed by Ola O'Murray and Alex Hall. You can keep up to date with us on Instagram at The Adventure Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch, then you can email info@theadventurepodcast.co.uk.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com, code program.
A change of seasons means adventures in rain, shine, mist, or snow, or all of the above on the same day. This season, prepare for every season with the Allbirds Mizzle Collection. With all-condition traction and materials and features to keep you comfy and dry no matter what, you'll be ready for anything. Go to allbirds.com and use code FRESHSOCKS for a free pair of socks with your purchase. Allbirds.com, code FRESHSOCKS.